Hi, I'm Steve Camland, and with my wife Leah, you're about to listen to our Insightful Adventures, a show that chronicles our travels around Australia and the savvy, scientific, and scenic things we experience along the way.
So this episode is going to cover roughly the first week of the new year. We traveled on New Year's Eve from Wyndham in Western Australia east to Katherine, Northern Territory. So we officially finally made it out of Western Australia into the Northern Territory. And that was 677 kilometers or 406 miles. So then on New Year's Day, we drove from Katherine northwest up to Litchfield National Park. And that was 396 kilometers or about 238 miles. The route between these national parks that we're going to talk about, Litchfield to Darwin to Kakadu, it makes roughly a big circle. And so from Litchfield National Park, we drove to Darwin, which is the capital of the Northern Territory. And that was in a northeast direction, 198 kilometers or 119 miles. And then from Darwin, we drove southeast to Kakadu National Park, which was 481 kilometers or about 289 miles. And then over those last 2 days, we traveled south from Kakadu and hit the Pebbles and Devil's Marbles. And over those 2 days, we traveled a total of 1,108 kilometers or 665 miles. Which made our trip a total of 2,850 kilometers or 1,710 miles, and we did that all in 6 days. So we finally crossed the Western Australia border and made it into the Northern Territory.
Finally.
Took us a while. We took our time, but we didn't take too long because we're on strict schedule.
To be fair, Western Australia is... all the states here in Australia are pretty ginormous.
Yeah. And so we were traveling. We were on the road New Year's Eve, and we decided to call in a night in the town of Katherine, Northern Territory. And Katherine, it was a smaller town, but it was a good place to stop because we were going to hit that circuit of Litchfield, Darwin, Kakadu the next day. We were going to start that circuit. Our New Year's Eve plans, there was like a local hot tub or a hot spring, but yeah, by 9 o'clock it just started downpouring rain and caught us off guard. And then anyways, we missed the New Year's Eve countdown. But we woke up the next day. So this is New Year's Day, and we drove to Litchfield National Park.
And Litchfield, it was a beautiful park, especially since it had a lot of waterfalls and since it had been raining a lot. The waterfalls were just gushing over. It was super pretty. And also, one of the downfalls, because it had been raining so much, a lot of the hikes or lookouts were closed. And during the dry season, you can swim in some of these like pools outside as the waterfalls come down. But because it was raining, the water was so high and rushing so much that, one, it was dangerous because of either flash floods or the water was rushing too much. And when the water level rises, there's an increased risk of crocodiles being in the area.
Yeah.
So for many reasons, you weren't able to swim, but it made for really awesome, pretty waterfalls.
Yeah, and there are several waterfalls. We went to Florence Falls, Tabletop Swamp, which was just mostly flooded. You couldn't actually walk anywhere, but there are lots of little tadpoles and almost frogs, tadpoles turning into frogs. Tolmer Falls, that was where we didn't realize the path was closed, and so we almost made it all the way down to the base of the waterfall before rangers had rounded up everybody and
kicked us out.
Yeah, made us turn back around.
Yeah, it was dumb.
And then Wangy Falls or Wangy Falls. But yeah, anyways.
And Wangy Falls was cool, but you couldn't even like make it that far. It was so flooded that the part where during the dry season you could actually walk to like the normal part of the pool, but it was flooded, like half the path was just flooded.
Yeah, to even get to the pool itself, like there were handrails that were underwater and most of sitting benches were underwater. It was crazy. And that night, it was kind of fun, though, because, again, it just sort of dumped rain at least once a day, just kind of out of nowhere. And so Steve and I were eating dinner at the Wangi or Wangi Falls, and we were making these epic pizzas.
Yeah, we figured out our camp stove has a little oven, quote unquote, and we can make these simple pizzas, which are pretty yummy.
Oh, they're so yummy. We got rained out, and so we like ran to this closed visitor center and finished off our pizzas, and it was really fun. But one of the things at Litchfield that's unique to Litchfield is that they have these magnetic termite mounds.
Yeah, so there's two types of termites that make termite mounds that are found in this park. And one of them are magnetic, and they make these super thin mounds, and they look like gravestones.
Yeah. It's just like a field. It's like a walkway, and you just look out, and it looks like, I mean, it's even the color of sort of cement, really thin cement, and the top. It's not a perfect dome, but it's almost like a square that's crumbled away on top. Yeah, and these magnetic termite mounds, I had heard about them before, but I had learned so much when we were in Litchfield. So these magnetic termite mounds, they're oriented on a north-south direction, and they're built with the least amount of surface area so that one side is always in the shade. So it's just a really, really thin slice of a termite mound that is seriously, all of them are pointing the same direction, just north-south. And the way that they know to align these termites, the way that the termites know to build a mound in the north-south direction so that it creates the least amount of surface area so that it doesn't overheat. These termites are blind, but they build them with their built-in compass, and it's the Earth's magnetic field that they're actually using to guide them.
Yeah, and scientists were able to test this so that in a controlled environment, they were able to switch the magnetic field to a different direction, so different than the Earth's natural magnetic field, and they still oriented themselves to the made-up magnetic field that the scientists were able to create, which concluded their hypothesis that these termites have this ability to sense magnetic north wherever it is, even if it changes in an environment. So they always build their termites that way so they can stay cool and don't cook in the heat.
Yeah, exactly. And these termites aren't the only animals to be able to sense this Earth's magnetic field. There's, I'm the most familiar with shark examples. There's a tiger shark, blue shark, and scalloped hammerheads that are all thought to detect this geomagnetic field and navigate based on the Earth's magnetic field. But I think some migratory birds are also able to sense and navigate that way too. So anyways, pretty cool.
Pretty cool termites.
And these cathedral termite mounds
are huge. They were probably like 10... over 10 feet tall.
Yeah, so they're often over 5 meters high, and these termites we're talking about are like 5 millimeters long.
So 5 meters, that's roughly 15 feet.
Yeah, just amazing. And cathedral mound is like the perfect word for it, because not only are they towering, but just the way that they're built above the ground, it looks like they're spires, and
It's crazy. And they say, scientists think, that they can live in these termite mounds for over 50 years.
Yeah. Like, I don't care about termites at all, but I really care about the termites in Litchfield.
And so one of the other things I thought was fascinating of why termites are so much in this area is because in Australia, there wasn't ever a lot of big grazing animals. So there wasn't, like, cows or sheep found naturally in Australia. And so there wasn't a way for the environment to kind of be recycled. So in a normal environment where they have a lot of cows, the cows would eat the grass, recycle it, pass it through, et cetera, et cetera. And in Australia, there aren't these big grazing animals. And so these termites developed in this area to essentially do the same thing that cows or sheep would. They recycle the vegetation. And so there's termite mounds everywhere. They're like every few feet, there's another termite mound.
Yeah.
But that's fascinating that these small little termites essentially do the same job as big, heavy cows do in other areas.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting, too. And these termite mounds, the other function that they can serve, at least termite mounds like the cathedral termite mounds, it can be a safe haven for animals that are stuck in a bushfire. So if there's like a bushfire raging through, goannas and small mammals and some other types of lizards are able to hide in these termite mounds, and it protects them from the bushfire. So these termites have a really important role in the ecosystems up here in the northern part of Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. They are cool.
Yeah. So after New Year's Day, we tried to wake up early to sneak out of Litchfield National Park.
So we stayed the night in Wangite Falls, and it poured rain on us again all night. And we didn't end up paying for the camping spot. So we were like, we'll just wake up early and get out before a ranger comes to check. So we got up early and we went, and there was a raging river over the over the road. And there's markers. Anytime where there's a potential for a road to flood, they always put these markers. And the water was at 0.6 of a meter, which is pretty high. And the water was flowing pretty fast. And we are in a four-wheel drive vehicle, but it's not raised super high. And so I was kind of worried of like, oh, man, 0.6 of a meter, that might be pushing it.
Yeah, so, and we were just kind of stuck in this little stretch of road because the road was flooded pretty much on either side of this Wangi Falls. And so we had to wait about 3 hours until the water subsided and finally crossed a road that was about...
It didn't subside all the way. It went down to 0.4 of a meter, so it went down 0.2. That was low enough for us to cross.
Yeah, that's still like over a foot of water.
Yeah,
though.
It was still kind of nerve-wracking. The water was still pretty high.
Yeah.
And there was three other crossings that we had to cross about the same depth. One was pretty long. By the time at the end of the park we came along, and it was a long crossing we came across, and there was just cars parked.
Oh, yeah.
Filming us. They were like, oh, can we get through? And it was a car and like a small sedan and some other small SUV. And I was like, probably not.
Yeah, they were taking pictures of us and Geronimo, like, you know, Geronimo's like parting the water,
That's the name of our car, by the way, Geronimo.
And yeah, we didn't realize the crossing was that long because it was on a curve, but they just thought it was amazing. And we're like, yeah, no, you shouldn't do that. We probably wouldn't have done it. We would have thought twice before we did it if we knew it was that long of a crossing.
Yeah, I would have, but we were halfway through and like, well, we just keep on going. Can't stop now.
Yeah. So after we finally escaped Litchfield National Park, we made our way up to Darwin.
And Darwin as a city I didn't really connect with Darwin as a city, but its history really fascinated me. So, Darwin was the first, so did the Japanese in World War II attack Darwin February 19th, 1942. I believe, and it was the first time Australia had been attacked by a foreign power, and it was the first time that the Japanese attacked it, but it was not the last. Actually, the Japanese ended up attacking Australia over 100 other times during World War II.
100 times?
Yeah, this was the biggest. So in World War, so this happened in 1942. Let me pull up my notes. The accounts kind of vary, but they think anywhere from 230 to over 250 people died during this attack. And yeah, it was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, the just Japanese, this unexpected air raid.
In fact, there's one funny story of a military guy who was taking a shower, heard the planes come, and there was... The Japanese attacked with two different raids of over 240 different aircrafts. So it was a big attack from the Japanese.
I can't imagine hundreds of airplanes flying overhead dropping bombs.
No, so this naval guy heard it. He was in the shower, ran outside, grabbed a machine gun, grabbed his buddy, put the machine gun on his buddy's shoulder, and just started firing away. He actually hit down one of four planes that was shot down during this attack. And then after the battle was over, he looked down. The guy was stark naked.
He didn't realize his towel had fallen off. That's like so Australia.
Yeah, just the guy ran out and just grabbed the machine gun, grabbed his buddy, and just started shooting. Him and his buddy both survived. And he, actually that guy, Wilbert Hudson, and he was awarded the Military Medal for Bravery. In fact, he was the first Australian awarded this for defending the homeland. So other people have been awarded this medal, but he was the first guy awarded it for defending Australia. And he did it stark naked.
Yeah, he did. Oh, man.
So that's a pretty funny story. So it was a pretty big deal. People kind of compare it to Pearl Harbor, and it was almost as big attack as Pearl Harbor. Not as many people died, because in Pearl Harbor, the USS Arizona accounted for almost half of the men that died during Pearl Harbor. But Australia had already declared war on Japan before this attack. And so it's different in that way. And also, my World War II history is pretty bad. I didn't realize how big the Japanese Empire, how much land they controlled.
Oh, no, me neither. They had these displays. I mean, the World War II history in Darwin is still so rich, so alive. They have tunnels, and they have artillery thing. I don't know. They have all this stuff. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So many airfields. Yeah. So it was just a great history lesson on World War II from a different perspective than we get as Americans.
Yeah, it was crazy. I didn't realize. So Japan, they controlled, I mean, obviously all of Japan, part of Russia, Serbia, part of China, and the majority of Southeast Asia. So all of Korea, all of Vietnam, all of Thailand, all of
Myanmar,
all
Indonesia,
of Indonesia,
Malaysia,
the Philippines, part of Papua New Guinea, and all the small islands in between. I mean, they're at the height of that empire. They controlled a lot of land. I did not know that.
No, and there's a scary map all in red that sort of shows this power just like emanating out of Japan and taking over.
Yeah, and the reason they attacked Australia is because Australia, they were allies or part of the allied group, and Australia made a great base to attack Japan, and so they thought if they could take out Australia, they could really hinder the allied progress, which was probably true, but Australia, they held on.
Yeah. Yeah, they did.
Anyways, I found that fascinating. I did not know all that World War II history. I feel like I should know that, but I didn't. So.
Yeah, and then so, we were only in Darwin for a day. Yeah, and there's more stuff to do there. Just Steve and I didn't have a lot of time, and we spent most of the day unexpectedly brushing up on World War II history. So after Darwin, we went to the spectacular jumping croc tour in the town of Adelaide River, which happened to be on the Adelaide River. So it was this tour, just like south on the way to Kakadu National Park. And there's a few different places that you can see crocs and feed crocs and blah, blah, blah. But Steve and I opted to see crocodiles in the wild. And they have this, you know, gimmick where they sort of make the crocodiles jump by sort of teasing them with a piece of meat and having them, like, propel with their tail. They tilt their body and put their snout directly in the air, and then they just quickly, wag their tail, but just, like, you know, move their tail up, and then they just, like, thrust themselves out of the water, and it looks like they're jumping, and then they'll do that a few times and give them some food. So
super cool to see these giant, they're big animals.
Yeah.
And they're scary.
Yeah. I think we covered that last time with my insight. I was very intimidated, but the people, there was one skipper and then two other handlers. I don't know what you'd call them, but it was two girls and the guy was a skipper, and they were so knowledgeable and they had so much respect for these crocodiles. And since the crocodiles are territorial, there's about 5,000 that are on the Adelaide River. And this specific company just tours a small little section of that river, and they knew every single crocodile. They said it was like they were an ice cream truck going up the river, and they knew everybody's territory. They had their name, and the motor of the boat is sort of that really annoying ice cream truck music that sort of calls in the crocs, and if they're hungry, they'll sort of swim up. And if it's they keep track and rotate who they feed, you know, and if it's their time, then they'll come up and do little jumps and get a treat.
Yeah, and these animals, yeah, I would never want to get in the water with one of these things. They just will. They're opportunist hunters. So they eat meat, and they just kind of eat whatever comes by their way. So sometimes if a kangaroo or I guess a wallaby more in that case, mm-hmm. they'll just eat it. And what I didn't know, which was super fascinating, is that crocodiles can go forever without eating. They don't have to like eat because of these special scales they have on their back.
Yeah. So crocodiles, they have these bony plates that we're all familiar with, you know, what they look like. But they are called osteoderms, each of those, they're small plates of bone. And these osteoderms, they line the back of the crocodile and from head to tail, and they form this tough protective armor. And then beneath those osteoderms, there is another layer of armor, and it's strong and flexible, and they are called osteocutes. And what's important about the osteocutes is that they're embedded in the animal's back tissue. And so it's this really blood-rich, bumpy scale. And because it's so blood-rich and because the color is black, they act as solar panels for these crocodiles.
Yeah, so these solar panels, they warm the crocodile. They warm its entire body. And so it doesn't have to eat as much because it doesn't need the energy to heat its body. Like, so we eat and we spend a lot of our energy keeping our body temperature where it needs to be. But these crocodiles, they don't have to get the energy they need to keep their temperature where it needs to be by eating. And so they said, the skipper said, they can go a couple of years without eating.
Oh, man, I don't remember that, but that's crazy.
Because they can sit there and regulate their body temperature with these solar panels.
That's amazing. Yeah, I remember them saying that they can hold their breath for like 1 to 4 hours, depending on how big the croc is. And so it doesn't matter if you don't see it in the water, like it could be there up to 4 hours.
And they can see you. The water's murky, but they can see you and they can sense you. Like any vibe, they have these special sensors that they can sense vibrations in the water. So even if they can't see you, they can feel any disturbances in the water and know where you're at.
Yeah. And crocodiles, they're protected now, but in the 1940s to 1960s, they were hunted near extinction, mostly for their skins. And finally, in 1971, they were fully protected. So even though they have protection, you can't shoot them in the wild unless there's an incident where they hurt a person and then they decide that they need to be put down. But there are farms, and these farms are what provide crocodile skin and meat, but they still rely on that wild population to supplement their stock. So right now, the numbers in the 1940s to 60s when they were hunted, there were only about 6,000 to 7,000. Nowadays, there's over 75,000. And that number's probably a little bit higher. And so because there's so many and these farms rely on the wild population, I've heard that they can harvest anywhere from 50,000 to 130,000 eggs each wet season. And then that quote is divided by different companies, different crocodile farms.
Yeah. Anyways, big, scary, fascinating animal.
So really, we learned a lot. And there wasn't even that much jumping for what it's worth. It was pretty much just, I'm pretty careful about wildlife tours and what we do. And I feel pretty good about the choice that we made to see these crocs in the wild. So highly recommend Spectacular Jumping Croc Tour.
And yeah. Then we went from there to Kakadu, and Kakadu, 98% of it was just all closed.
Oh, so closed. Yeah, so everything we wanted to do was closed.
The only thing that we were able to do to see were some Aboriginal rock art, which was pretty cool. And it was different art than we had previously seen, and some really big stuff. So that was, it was cool to see some rock art. It ended up being like a 6-hour detour through the park just to see that art.
Yeah, it's
true. Because it was closed.
But it's still the best Aboriginal rock art that I've seen, actually.
That is probably true.
Yeah, like for me, it was the best. So just quickly with the rock art, because that's all that we were able to do there, even though there's a lot to do in Kakadu. There's gorges, there's waterfalls, there's hikes, there's four-wheel drive tracks. It's awesome. I've only heard good things, but we weren't able to do anything except look at some rock art. My favorite rock art was of, in part of it, it depicted Namarong. I know I'm saying that wrong, but it's the Lightning Man. And it's this guy, we'll have to post a picture on Instagram because it was like my favorite thing. So he has these stone axes on his knees and his elbows, and that's what makes the thunder. And the traditional owners there, there's three main languages spoken by the Aboriginals that live in the area. And they've been there for about 50,000 years. But it's the Binning and the Mungoy that are the traditional owners there. And what they say about the Lightning Man is that the lightning are his children, but that the lightning has another form as this like two-toned grasshopper. And when the grasshoppers are seen in the early storm season, the Aboriginals know that it's time to seek shelter.
Stay away from the rain. Yeah. And they said that this Lightning Man still lives in the area. There's like this certain cliff area that you can't go to because that's where he lives.
Yeah, because there's definitely still sacred sites and a lot of these Aboriginal places that you're not allowed to go to. But just because it's sacred doesn't mean it's necessarily positive sacred. Sometimes it's sacred and off limits because it's a dangerous place to go. And where the Lightning Man lives on that cliff is a dangerous place to go.
Yeah. So then we went from there and we spent the night at a place called the Pebbles, which is attached to the following, which the Devil's Marbles, Devil's.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. That was just a kind of a quick little stop, just some more, I don't know what you call it, some
it's
rock
just these
formations.
Yeah, it's granite boulders. And so both the Pebbles and Devil's Marbles are part of an Aboriginal's women Dreamtime site. And so the Pebbles, which is called Kunjara, just has sort of these miniature, when I say miniature, they're still really big granite boulders. And then further down south, as we made our way eventually to Alice Springs, we came to Devil's Marbles, which is Karlu Karlu. And that's part of it is a registered sacred site. And that area around Karlu Karlu was a meeting place where neighboring language groups conducted sacred ceremonies. Yeah, so that was basically our adventures in the top end of the Northern Territory.
Yeah, it was great.
It was awesome.
So in the last segment of our podcast, we share either a personal insight, something that we learned among our travels, or a little adventure that wasn't covered earlier. And so I'll share the insight today. And my insight is that here in Australia, when they talk about their veterans or wars, they call them the Anzacs, which is Australian and New Zealand Armed Forces. And usually it's in the context of World War One. And the Anzac force was deployed to Gallipoli in what is known now as Turkey. And it was actually a failed campaign in World War One. But that's usually the context, and when they talk about their veterans or the military force is and under this the World War One Gallipoli campaign. And it's quite different than our American mentality. So Australians, when they talk about their veterans, it's really in this humble soberness mentality, as they recognize what their veterans went through or go through in war, and they use this Gallipoli as kind of the example of war is tough, it's hard on all the armed forces, and they are really somber about it, and they really recognize the trials and the cost that war takes, not just from their veterans, but from everybody in Australia. And especially in World War One, Australia was such a young country. I mean, it is a young country even then. And so it's not in this... And as an American, when we talk about our veterans or war, it's like we are the biggest, most badass, we kick ass, like we are awesome, we like win.
We focus on the victories of the war.
Yeah, we talk about like World War Two, like we saved the world from, you know, fascism, go us, and we don't really, you know, we try to hide all our mistakes. We try to hide, you know, we don't like to talk about Vietnam or Korea, you know, like, oh, we don't want to talk about that. But we want to talk about when we were awesome because we are so cool and there's fireworks when we celebrate it. And that's not bad. It's just so different here in Australia. Here in Australia, it's about the cost and the realities of war, not necessarily like how awesome their military force is. They are patriotic people. They just present it in a different way than, for example, us as Americans.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. So my adventure for this trip is kind of threefold, but I'm putting it under the umbrella of roadhouse adventures. So I don't know if we have roadhouses back in the States, but there are roadhouses out here that is, it's just basically you're on a long stretch of road and there is a gas station with somebody's house attached to the back, and that's just sort of a roadhouse. And so we've come across three very interesting roadhouses on the top end, which is sort of what you refer to that top end of
Northern Territory. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was one roadhouse in Adelaide River that has the original stuffed buffalo from Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, that buffalo, when he's on the, they're on the road and there's a big bull, and Crocodile Dundee gets out of the truck and he hypnotizes it and the bull like lays down. They have that bull stuffed, taxidermied in this bar.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there was, so that's at the Adelaide Inn Pub, or it's called the 303 Bar, if anybody's interested in seeing that. It's worth like the 2 seconds it takes to go on and take a picture of the bull. I mean, sorry, of the buffalo. And then also in that region, there was a town with a gas station that had just a whole bunch of snakes in glass cages. What do you call that? A reptile house. Yeah, but it was just a whole bunch of like pythons and snakes that you could go to. And then the most interesting little adventure we had was hitting up, it's right by the Devil's Marbles, in a town called Wycliffe. And it is self-proclaimed the alien capital of Australia. Oh, sorry, it's called Wycliffe Well. And it's a self-proclaimed alien capital of Australia. And it's pretty much just a glorified gas station with a cafe. And it has these, like, newspaper clippings of alien sightings across the world.
Yeah, apparently the guy that originally owned it saw a UFO there and then built his house and gas station around it. You could get fingerings. We walked in there. It had just been purchased, like, 9 months earlier by a few Indian guys. And so they didn't really know the story because the original guy had sold it.
And moved away.
And moved away.
We wanted to interview him.
We would have interviewed him in a second had he been there. So yeah. That was, it would have been cool to actually talk to the guy. But the people that now own it didn't really know, and they just kind of bought the business.
Yeah, exactly. But that was still a fun adventure because it was part gas station, part cafe, part alien museum, and part Aboriginal art gallery.
And roadhouse. You could stay there if you wanted.
Oh, yeah. And roadhouse, because you could actually sleep there. Yeah. So that was a fun adventure, just checking out some of the roadhouses along the way. We need to do a special shout out to Ellen DeCruz. A few days ago, we posted on our Insightful Adventures Instagram page a picture of a current adventure we're having in Coopapeete. And it was a picture of a spaceship. And Ellen DeCruz guessed the correct movie. So there's the ship in Pitch Black in the town of Coopapeete, which is actually in South Australia now. And shout out to Ellen. Shout out to all of my other buddies in the Marine Ecology Group Fish Lab, because they're awesome. Hi, guys.
And that's our podcast. Thank you for listening. You can catch us on Instagram at Insightful Adventures. It's a great place to see photos we posted from our episodes and see where we are currently. And it's a great place to connect with us. And catch us next week for when we talk about Uluru.
Oh, man, you guys. This.
Which we're so excited about, so you have to listen to that episode.
Yeah, it's Uluru, it's Katajuda, it's Kings Canyon, it's Alice Springs. There's some good stuff in there. Uluru was so special, you have to listen.
Yes, it was awesome. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Thank you.